Good evening. What a delightful sight to look around the room at all of you. And also, you can, pull out cushions from under there. So, I've seen everybody here before, but is there anybody who's here for the first time? Ah, yes, that's right. Welcome. And welcome back to everyone else. I'm going to make reference to a couple of things in the talk I'm going to give that I want to just give a little bit of definition first. I'm going to use the term patched robe. And I want to just explain that the patched robe, technically, it's this robe. And if you look around the room, you can see some people have brown ones, some people have black ones, some people are wearing small robes around their necks, blue robes. Those are considered robes, too. It's Buddha's robe. And we call it patched robe because we sew together a whole bunch of little patches to make these robes. But I also want to invite you, if you don't have on an actual cloth robe tonight, I want to invite you to think of yourself for you tonight, you might think of the patched robe is whatever is your deepest intention or vow or why you're here, why you're interested in Buddhism, what you would hope that Buddhism would have to offer. So when I talk about the patched robe, it's going to come up in a story, but I don't want it to be this mysterious thing, though of course it is. But you might think, imagine that we all have on a patched robe of some sort tonight, seen and unseen. So many, many hundreds of years ago, two of the ancestors in our lineage, at the time of this story, one of them was one of our ancestors. I'll use the Japanese names because that's what we chant, Doan Kanchi. He was the 41st ancestor. And so one of the other monks that he practiced with was his attendant often. You know, we have attendants. Johnny was the attendant tonight. He brought me my books and offered the incense. And so he was often carrying, the attendant was Ryozan Enkan, and he was often carrying the robe for the teacher. He found himself holding the robe a lot. So, you know, these stories, they were written down hundreds of years ago. Who knows what really happened, but we like to imagine it happened just the way that we read it and tell it. So I'll make it my own here. So there was Doan Kanchi, and there was Ryozan Enkan holding his robe, and Doan Kanchi turned to Ryozan Enkan and said, what is the business under the patched robe? Poor old Ryozan Enkan, he went, I don't know. He didn't know. And Doan Kanchi said, to wear this robe and not understand the great matter is the greatest suffering. Now you ask me. And so Ryozan Enkan said, what is the business beneath the patched robe? And Doan Kanchi said, it's intimacy. Intimacy. And Ryozan Enkan, does anybody know what happened? He started to cry. He wept. He wept. It's like that. He just got it. He wept. He received what his Dharma brother was saying. And so Doan Kanchi said, oh, well, what is it that you've understood? Can you express it? And he said, what is the business under the patched robe? Intimacy. And then Doan Kanchi said, yes, intimacy and even greater intimacy. Now, this was actually for Ryozan Enkan, his awakening experience. If you go and you read the book called The Transmission of the Light, which is the description from Shakyamuni Buddha down through a couple of ancestors after Ehe Dogen. So it doesn't go all the way to Catherine and to those wearing a brown robe here in the book. Hopefully someday there will be such a book. But these stories are these person-to-person experiences between one human being and another, where the person in the role of Doan Kanchi, the teacher, recognized that the student had understood the deepest truth of this whole thing. The whole truth of this whole thing is not about memorizing sutras, and it's not about bowing, and it's not even about sitting zazen. It's about the direct experience of the intimacy with all things. And in fact, in some of the teachings, the word wisdom and the word intimacy are used synonymous, So I wanted to offer this story and talk a little bit, talk the whole night about intimacy. we can talk a little bit about the story too. And that's fine if when we get into the question section, if you want to ask or talk about things about the story. But I really wanted to kind of unfold and unpack together what is this intimacy. And what is it that if we don't understand it and yet we wear the robe, that is the greatest suffering, you know? I mean, that's the kind of teaching that makes me love Zen, because that kind of really speaks to my experience. I recently, well, these last few days, I was poking around and studying in another Buddhist tradition. And, you know, there's a lot of different Buddhist traditions. There's a lot of different countries that practice Buddhism and a lot of different styles of Buddhism. And this particular style of Buddhism has a lot of certainty in it. Like, if you do this, you're going to get enlightened. If you do these steps, you will realize the great way. If you do these things and don't do these things in your personal life, you are guaranteed to, you know, to get it. And I think, well, God, lucky for people for whom that works. But, you know, what I guess I'm attracted to in Zen is it's not so sure, you know, if the enlightenment is, you know, wearing this robe and not understanding the great matter is the greatest suffering. What does that mean? That's Zen. That's what we do in Zen, is we sit and we go, oh God, what does that mean? That's kind of scary. I don't know if I like that. And then we sit with that. And we sit till it starts soaking down into our bodies and then we cry when we have an experience of what that might mean. And that's the teaching that is transmitted that's beyond the sutras, which is the identifying characteristic of the Zen school, is that it isn't about anything that you can read. You have to experience it yourself. And in the case of transmission, experience it with another. So is there anybody here who is not aware of who Catherine is? Can you raise your hand? Anybody else? Okay, so if you look on the altar, you see a smiling lady there. And until fairly recently, she sat there. That was her chair. She was our abbot. And she practiced here for almost 20 years with us. And she passed away a few weeks ago. So I want to talk not so much about Catherine, but I want to try to evoke her words about intimacy, because I think that was one of her most important teachings. She's the one who first told me this story about the suffering, if you to wear the robe and not understand the great matter. is the greatest suffering. Probably she told that to me at a time when I was suffering with the whole thing of, what is this? Why am I wearing it? What does it mean? And, you know, and then she told me that story. And I probably cried, you know. So that's why I always think about her when I think about intimacy, because that was her teaching style, was to really stay, to be very close with people. And that doesn't always mean that it felt good. In fact, maybe often it didn't. Intimacy doesn't mean like and dislike. It doesn't mean having a good time or having a bad time. It means you're close. You're like nose to nose, you know, body to body, breath to breath. So I was thinking, you know, about the week, the few weeks that we spent together, you know, taking care of her before she died and then after she died and the ceremonies that we had. And I know most of the people in this room did something, not everybody, and so maybe I can just describe some of the kinds of ways that I believe that we were all practicing this great matter of intimacy. And actually, in Zen, the term the great matter is what we use for birth and death. That's the great matter. That's like the most important thing is birth and death. So here we were, someone was going through her passage of moving from life into death, something that we will all do. Everybody here is going to get to have that experience, and we will probably be there for each other, many of us, as that happens. But that intimacy, the intimacy of sitting with her before she died and she was breathing, you know, for days. That was it. That was her teaching. That was her deep, deep teaching of intimacy. We were sitting with her as she was breathing. The intimacy we had with one another as we took care of her, as we brought each other food, as we held each other, as people cried, as we laughed, as we confessed, as we told stories about her. And then, of course, all the ceremonies that we did here. Intimacy. Intimacy. Great intimacy. And it's no surprise to me that her final teaching was the intimacy of her breath and her body. That's what it came down to. She wasn't talking. Her eyes weren't open. It was just the breath and just the body and our breath and our body. So I would like to actually read several things, and we can talk about them. You know, I think Catherine struggled a lot with the dimension of the mind. I think mental stuff was hard for her. She was brilliant, but I think that there was suffering in the mental realm. But I think there was peace in her body, and maybe that's why she emphasized the body so much in her teachings with us, was because she was very grounded in her body, and I think we saw that at the end. We were amazed at how even, what was it, 5 days after losing consciousness, she was breathing really solid. And everybody was going, wow. In a way, I wasn't surprised. It's like, yeah, she was very, very, very solid in her breath. So what I would like to do is read for you a fairly early exchange that she had with a student. This was in 1996, and it was during Sesshin, which are the multi-day retreats that we do up Jokoji Mountain Zen Center. And I think I have a lot of affection for this particular transcript. It's one that I made at that time. I took all the tapes home, and I transcribed them all because I wanted to hold on to the words because the experience had been very powerful. And now I'm really glad I did that. I'm glad I have. I'm glad I have these words. Because I think what happens is, with a lot of her talks, she would edit them. And she would make them presentable for publication. And I just love that this is unedited. This is verbatim. And so I'm going to read it that way. I want to read the unedited, verbatim way that many of us met her. And in this time, I think she was really starting to find her own voice. I know her first few years here, she was trying to teach the way that her teachers had taught. And she was trying to teach the way Katagiri Roshi had taught her and the way Suzuki Roshi had taught her and Reb and Richard Baker. And there was a time when, in fact, I remember at this sesshin, the first day she was talking about the Genjo Koan, which is one of the writings that we study, the actualization of everyday teaching. And she was explaining the first day in this quite intellectual manner about the A world and the B world and the C world and this analysis of this teaching. And kind of around this exchange with this student, she started to shift out of the intellectual teaching and into what I believe was one of her great modes of teaching, which was helping us to be in our bodies. So I want to read a little bit to you here about her, what she said to this person. This person was talking about how much fear he experienced and was asking her throughout the 5 days, what am I supposed to do with this great fear that I have? The fear that I'm going to fail and that I can't handle what's happening in my life. And so Catherine said, I think fear is like desire. The more we feed it, the more it cooks. The more it comes up. Try satisfying desire sometime and see if it goes away. The thing about fear, I think it's wonderful that you've seen that fear is pervasive. It keeps arising. So what would you imagine that you would do? What's the only thing you can do? Stop veering off now. What can you do? Here's fear right in front of you. And the student said, well, you taught me to look at it. And she said, go into it. It's deeper than backing off and looking at it from a distance. You take a little step toward it, keep it in view. Then you take another little step. You go as slowly as you need to. You might come up right and kind of put your nose out. Maybe you don't want to get that close. You can only do what your stomach can do. And so you do it slowly, at the pace at which your stomach and your heart can handle it. But it's always going to be there as a demon in your life unless you walk into it and make friends. Walk in and sit down. Listen, you're not bigger than I. I have the idea that you're bigger and that you're going to destroy me, but let's check it out. Walk in and become the fear. See, it's only scary because you put it outside. We put it outside. It's just a manifestation of some energy. Look at it as energy. So one way to deal with this stuff, which I've been working with in another realm, is, oh, hello, I'm glad you're here. Which is absolutely the opposite of what we want to do. We go, ew, right? We get really tight and solid, and so does fear. Now, if you go, gee, I'm so glad you came again. Here you are again. And relax and just sat there with that. Then it's going to relax too. It might even become, who knows what might happen. It might extend its arm to you and say, hi. It might dissolve. It might change shape. It might get bigger. But it's never going to be bigger than you because it's a product of your energy. So you think, here's Philip, here's the shape of Philip, and here's fear. Fear is never greater than the shape of Philip. That was his name. It just feels like it extends to all the realms and all the universes. So what you have to do ultimately, when you can, when you're ready, when your heart is ready and your mind and your stomach, is to get up close to it, breathe it, smell it, listen to it, touch it. It has to come into the body because it's the body that put it outside. It's the body that closed down and said, I'm not going to know that. That's the best work we can do. I think fear is ultimately the thing that's behind all of our strategies for avoiding life. All of these things we're talking about are strategies for avoiding life, right? Because we don't want life to be the way it is. We've all got a better idea of how life can be. It would be pretty uninteresting if life ended up being our idea of it. That's why we sit this way. This is not our idea of how to spend 5 days, but sometimes we get into it. Look at this, you're all coming back. There's something here, and it's about this, I think. Kind of hard to know what to say after that. I have more of her words, and I find myself just wanting to just bring them forth, but I also want to be responsible about giving a Dharma talk. So I'm going to hold off on reading another section. So maybe we could think about the case a little bit, and then I promise you we'll return to hearing some more of her voice from that sesshin. But the case... that the great matter is about intimacy and the recognition of the truth of that were the tears of Ryozan Enkan. You know, a lot of times I think I notice that when people cry, they apologize. Oh, excuse me. Oh, you know, here, quickly, you know, get the tissue and wipe the tears away. And, you know, it's some kind of sign of weakness or something. But this is just an informal poll. How many of you have ever, in the Zendo or while studying Zen or doing anything around Buddhism, practicing, whatever, have you ever cried? What is it for you? What brings tears to your eyes in studying the great matter? Yeah. Can I ask you of an example?
Several of Dogen's writings and the way that he brings forth the Dharma, you know, come to mind immediately. But you know, it can be a lot of things. It can be Suzuki Roshi's writings, also, or just. Being here, listening to you or whoever's up there giving a talk. You never know when it's going to come, the intimacy. It's kind of hidden.
Yeah. So tears of intimacy, inspired by intimacy.
Mentioned the intimacy of us all being around Catherine, listening to her breathe, tears were running down my face then. Mm-hmm. And it was because it sent me back to that moment. Mm-hmm. And remembering not only her, but community. Mm-hmm. And the closeness and the intention of people being present with just what was going on right then. And it's so interesting that you could just say a few words and it would just And I'm sure it's true for a lot of people here. It put me right at there. You know, it was only a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And so it's real fresh in my memory. And yet, the memory is just very touching, mm-hmm. what that felt like. Mm-hmm.
The intention to be present, mm-hmm. I heard you say.
No agenda, mm-hmm. other than just being there.
That's it. That's the intimacy beneath the patched robe. Yeah.
Well, I think like during sessions, I cry often when I'm kind of up against the wall of my inability to just be present.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, it's kind of like, I can't do this. but I'm doing it anyway. Sort of. It's a very vulnerable kind of acknowledgement of kind of what is, and without I can't make it into anything else, and it's just what it is.
I might. Tell me if I'm not understanding correctly, but when you said that you find yourself sometimes crying because you're feeling like you're not getting it or you can't get it, I'm struck by that. Maybe that is part of the teaching that Dawan Kanchi is offering, that, you know, to have this intention and to want it so badly and yet to feel like I don't understand it, I can't do it. He's calling that the greatest suffering.
Yeah. Yep.
And really, I think that is an intimacy as well, because you wouldn't be suffering if it wasn't something that was very important. Yeah. Otherwise, it'd be like, who cares? Let's just go home.
Right.
Let's just drive home. Yeah.
No, usually I take that as a good sign.
Yeah.
I'm not just kind of spaced out and,
yeah.
you know, dead.
It matters to you.
Yeah.
It matters. Yeah. Which is, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about this practice is that, you know, we just make all of this up. And so any of this meaning that we're getting or any of these things that we're feeling inspired by and inspired to, you know, take on the robe or just to come on a Wednesday night, you know, there's nothing inherently meaningful in any of this. You know, it's your own desire to have there be something that is meaningful that matters. You know, anybody else want to just share a little bit about what, for you, what the tears are when they come in this practice?
Yes. this case question is on my rugs.
Oh,
it says,
hey.
What is beneath the robe? I came to this practice, they have to a great deal of challenge, trying to penetrate teachers' boundaries and really get there. My teacher was Rev, and for 9 months we would meet, and I would come, and I was accustomed to be calling myself feral monk. And I was prepared to give all that up completely and just be completely open to whatever name he would give me in Chukka. And I was prepared to give it all up. Mm-hmm. Here we are with all these people around in Green Gulch. And, he gave me a name. Which in Japanese means feral spirit.
Oh.
And I was prepared to give up my identity, not knowing if it was really me. And I guess he said it was.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That's what Yase means.
Hmm. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yasikaige means feral spirit reset flower. So.
That's a good name for you.
I guess.
I think so.
Right.
And now I'm crying. But see, here's the thing about crying. Okay, I won't, you know, keep rubbing it in, because we could just really go for it. And I see I'm looking at the clock as well. But you see, this is the thing. Right in the book, in our sacred book about the ancestors, that's what Ryozan Enkan did. He cried. So there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, that was his awakening. And his teacher saw that and said, "You're now the 42nd ancestor." So, you know, no shame in showing our feelings here. Ryozan Enkan, he's the man who gives us that modeling. So Catherine used to like to make us cry in Sesshin. And I want to read you something that she read that was making us cry. But before that, I want to just read, just because I have the bully pulpit and because I think it's so delightful, I just wanted to read this. And for those of you, I know some of you are studying the Genjo Koan on Tuesday mornings. I thought you might get a kick out of this. And I apologize if this seems like Zen in language. For those who haven't studied it, it's probably going to be like, those words don't mean anything to me. So I'm not going to belabor it, but I can't resist. It's a poem that has a lot of poetic images in it, for those of you who haven't read it. So this was, to me, this is another example of the intimacy of the student-teacher relationship. And here it was students. I don't know how many of us were there, but it was this back and forth. So Catherine said, "Somebody said yesterday that she liked just hearing the poetry of the Genjo Koan. So I thought maybe I would just sit here and read it to you. Do you want to hear the whole Genjo Koan, or do you want to talk about it?" And somebody said, "I wouldn't mind hearing it, because I think it's the first time I can actually hear it up here. It would be wonderful to hear it in this place. Maybe not the whole thing, but a little bit." Catherine asked, "Does everybody feel that way?" Participant said, "Oh, especially the part about the moon and the reflection." She said, "Oh, we can have a favorite part, and I'll read that part." And then someone else said, "Oh, please, Catherine, read the part about the moon." And everybody laughed, like bedtime stories. She says, "As long as you don't go to sleep." And then she asks Patrick, "What's your favorite part?" And he said, "Oh, the last paragraph about the cream on the great river." "Got it." And then another participant said, "Oh, no wonder you wanted to be Tenzo." And then she says, "Any other requests?"
"Was Tenzo in 1990?
I don't know. So then another participant says, "Oh, I like the part about the fish swimming in the water that stays in its element and the bird flying in the air." And then Catherine says, "Oh, do you want in any particular order?" So anyhow, and then she read us the entire Genjo Koan. So, and then she read this, and bear with me. Mary Oliver didn't just write poetry, but she wrote about writing. And this was at the end of the Sesshin. And we'd been having a lot of conversation about the Genjo Koan. We'd been hearing poetry. We'd been crying. We'd been, you know, sitting and doing all the crazy things we do when we sit a Sesshin. And then she read this, not short, it's about a page of text, but I think it's worth reading, because I think that, I think Catherine had some, she kind of had a strict presentation a lot of the time, and I think she had some shyness about sharing her vulnerable side sometimes. But I think she let Mary Oliver do it for her. And I think that's maybe why it's so tender and precious for those of us that were there at the time when she was sharing, because, you know, she wouldn't say it, but she'd let her friend say it. And I think that her selection of these words to close Sesshin is a perfect example of that. So I want to, again, share it with you, because I'm sure this wasn't put into the newsletter when she edited this talk. So I will let you know when it's Catherine talking and when it's Mary Oliver talking. So Mary Oliver starts writing about writing. She says, "I read my books with diligence and mounting skill and gathering certainty. I read the way a person might swim to save his or her life. I write that way too." And Catherine says, "This is the fundamental point. We do this to save our life. We wouldn't do this if we didn't absolutely have to do it. If we could think of something better to do with these 5 days, maybe some of us would do it. But we need to do this to save our lives." Do you have more tolerance for reading? Well, would anybody dare say they're fed up? This is Sasheen, right? And then she goes on reading. Mary Oliver, "I did not think of language as the means to self-description. I thought of it as the door, a thousand opening doors past myself. I thought of it as the means to notice, to contemplate, to praise, and thus to come into power. In books there was truth, daring, passion of all sorts, clear and sweet and savory emotion did not run in a rippling stream in my personal world, more pity to it. But in stories and poems I found passion unfettered. Not that such feelings were always or even commonly found in their clearest, most delectable states in all the books I read." And Catherine says, "Her language is so juicy." Back to Mary Oliver, "Not at all. I saw what skill was needed and persistence. How one must bend one's spine like a hoop over the page. The long labor. I saw the difference between doing nothing or doing a little and the redemptive act of true effort." Catherine says, "Let me read that again. We all have this choice to make many times in our lives. I saw the difference between doing nothing or doing a little and the redemptive act of true effort. Reading, then writing, then desiring to write well, shaped in me that most joyful of circumstances, a passion for work." And Catherine says, "Remember, I read yesterday how she says it takes her 70 hours to drag a poem into the light, and her poems are very short." So back to Mary. "Deep in the woods, I tried walking on all fours. I did it for an hour or so through thickets, across a field, down to a cranberry bog. I don't think anyone saw me. At the end, I was exhausted and sore, but I had seen the world from the level of the grasses. The first bursting growth of trees, declivities, lumps, slopes, rivulets, gashes, open spaces. I was some slow old fox, wandering, breathing, hitching along, lying down finally at the edge of the bog under the swirling rickrack of the trees. You must not ever stop being whimsical, and you must not ever give anyone else the responsibility for your life. I don't mean it's easy or assured. There are the stubborn stumps of shame, grief that remains unsolvable after all the years, a bag of stones that goes with one wherever one goes and however the hour may call for dancing and for light feet. But there is also the summoning world, the admirable energies of the world, better than anger, better than bitterness. And there is the thing that one does, the needle one plies, the work. And within that work, a chance to take thoughts that are hot and formless and to place them slowly and with meticulous effort into some shapely heat-retaining form. Even as the gods or nature or the soundless wheels of time have made forms all across the soft curved universe. That is to say, Having chosen to claim my life, I have made for myself out of my work and love a handsome life. And then on the tape, there's this silence, and you just hear everybody going, breathing. And then Catherine says, there are two more pages. Reading, I did not give to anyone the responsibility for my life. It is mine. I made it and can do what I want with it, live it, give it back someday without bitterness to the wild and needy dunes. And by this point, you hear one of the participants weeping. Oh, stop! She says, you want me to stop? It's hard to stop, isn't it? And then there's a whole bunch of laughter that flows around the room. And the last words she says, which I think were the last words of this sesshin, she says, what a meal. Closes the book. Right? So it feels very intimate for me to kind of conjure up these words and her voice. Obviously, I'm sorry, Catherine. Of course, I didn't elaborate, but I read it dramatically. She used to get mad at me for being overly dramatic and thought my intonation was too up and down. She was always trying to make it go like this, but she failed. But that was our intimacy, you know, our back and forth. Her trying to make me be something and me being whatever I was. And then, but, you know, Johnny, actually, you're sharing about your name. You know, she was always telling me to lower my voice because I have a rather loud voice. But you know what name she gave me on my Rakasu? Bright Song. You know. So there's that intimate koan. It's like, shh, quiet, lower your voice, Bright Song. So we have a little, a few minutes, if anybody else would like to say anything. Yeah.
What a meal.
You're welcome. There's a treasure trove. You know, Kokyo just has been encouraging me to find some of the older CDs so we can get some of her stuff online. But, you know, this is cassette. There's, you know, hundreds of cassettes. So I don't know how we're going to do that, but there's a treasure trove. Anybody else? Beings are numberless.